dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a delight and a real honor to be able to pipe aboard, as they say, a four-star admiral of great distinction, a man I've come to know and admire greatly as a friend and as the chairman of the Military Committee of the Center for Security Policy, the former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, James Ace Lyons. Admiral Lyons, we are reaching out to you on the eve of the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. It is a great privilege to have a chance to visit with you about that. You served in the Navy from, I guess, the very latter parts of World War II, right up into the mid-1980s. And it's a perspective that I think it's enormously important to bring to bear. You've written about Pearl in the commentary section of the Washington Times yesterday, and I'm very glad to have you here to talk with us about it today. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Frank, and your listeners.
Let's talk a little bit about the events that led up to Pearl Harbor. You've reviewed in this column, Admiral Lyons, two books that shed light on what was known by the United States government, or at least parts of the United States government, in the run-up to Pearl Harbor. Speak, if you would, to this nagging question of what did Franklin Roosevelt and others around him know, and when did they know it?
Well, of course, as I said in the op-ed and in the recent books on this, we had broken the key Japanese diplomatic code, and which provided a wealth of information leading up to the attack on 7 December, including such information as the request for the pattern of the anchorages at Pearl Harbor, which in fact became a bombing plot for the Japanese attack. But, you know, one thing I didn't get in the op-ed because just of the time, there was an effort in the summer of 41 to establish a truce with Japan over the invasion of the Japanese in China. And what's fascinating here was the double agents, the communists, who had infiltrated into our government organizations prior to in the 30s and certainly early 40s, were able to sabotage that effort. Our ambassador, Gru, in Tokyo, felt he could have been successful. But what the Soviets did then, because when Hitler invaded Russia in the summer of 41, the last thing Stalin needed was a two-front war. So they put their most successful spy in Tokyo, a German-born communist by the name of Soto. And his main effort was to ensure if the Japanese did anything to go into a global war, they went south against the British, the Dutch, and the Americans. The objective was to prevent Japan from opening up a second front against Russia.
Admiral, let me just ask you about your predecessor as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, Admiral Husband Kimmel, and Lieutenant General Walter Short, who was responsible for the defense of Hawaii in the days leading up to Pearl Harbor, were essentially made the fall guys for what happened in that attack. Talk a little bit about what they knew and were unaware of, and whether it was appropriate for them to be treated as the villains of the piece.
Well, what happened was they were not provided any information, any of the intelligence information leading up to the attack. In fact, you know, there were something like 6 or 7 purple machines made. And what your listeners have to know, a few of those went to Churchill in the UK. The Army had 2, the Navy had 2. And remarkably, 1 was sent to MacArthur in the Philippines for his use. None, unbelievable.
And these, of course, were the machines used to decrypt the Chinese purple code, the diplomatic code known as MAGIC at the time. And Admiral Lyons, had they had access to the information that would have been made accessible with one of those machines, is it your professional judgment that they might have taken steps to intensify their defenses against a Japanese attack and Pearl Harbor perhaps been avoided?
Well, there's no question about it. And there's also the other thing that I mentioned was the most successful British double agent who actually brought over the questions that the Japanese wanted on Pearl Harbor. Actually, the UK attack on the Italian fleet at Taranto was the model that they used for the attack on Pearl Harbor. And in that, they raised a series of questions. Those questions were brought by Duco Popoff to the United States, turned over to the FBI, who then paraphrased the questions, gave them to military intelligence, who really failed to recognize the significance of them.
So this was one of a series of episodes or intelligence data points, if you will, that could have resulted in early warning and advance preparations. Do you credit Admiral Lyons the contention that's widely advanced but often disputed that Roosevelt knew about this attack or had access to plenty of information that would have signaled the attack and deliberately failed to warn those who were about to be subjected to it? What do you make of that?
Well, let's face it. He ran on the platform of keeping us out of the European conflict and not to keep us involved. So there was the strong isolationist, drumbeat throughout the United States to keep us out of the European war. And it had to be a dramatic event. Whether he deliberately failed to act, that remains one of the great unknowns. And I do know, you know, he, and certainly at the same time, Churchill was getting the same information. You know, and it's hard to really come to the conclusion that neither Churchill or Roosevelt failed to discuss any of the information leading up to the attack. But most importantly, Frank, besides the whether he had it weeks or months before, they had the key message on the 6th of December, which was the Japanese delivery that they were breaking off all negotiations, to which Roosevelt said, "This means war." And for nobody to pick up to pass this information to Kimmel and Short was unconscionable.
And then to blame them for it is even more so, and I think you rightly argue that they should be pardoned and their ranks restored, now obviously posthumously, as a small measure of recompense for what they were put through as a result of these various charges. Admiral Lyons, we're going to pause here for just a moment. We've got the groundwork laid here for what led to World War II, our involvement in it in the Pacific and almost immediately simultaneously in Europe. I'd like to take stock with you in a second segment, if we may, of sort of what flowed from all of that, not just the war, of course, but in the post-war period, Pax Americana, in which you played a very important role, of course, in the United States Navy, notably as the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. That and much more with Admiral James Ace Lyons, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're talking with Admiral James Ace Lyons, a distinguished veteran of the United States Navy, served in very senior positions as a 4-star admiral in the Navy, capping some 40-year career. He's a man these days very actively contributing, I'm pleased to say, among other things, as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, but also as a regular contributor to the Washington Times about the various challenges, national security and otherwise, facing our country. Admiral, we were talking about what got us into World War II 75 years ago. Tomorrow, we will doubtless be spending a lot of time in the days ahead reminiscing about the war years that followed from all of that. I'd like to sort of jump forward to the end of the war and what the United States was able to do as truly the world's greatest power to help establish a new sort of Pax Americana, I guess it's called, in the Pacific notably, but really around the world. You played a very important role in that for many, many years. Talk a little bit about the significance of what we did and its value even unto this day.
Well, of course, what we had to do, one of the great success stories is how we turned a hardened enemy into a staunch ally in Japan, and where they became one of the economic engines and one of the great success stories of the Pacific, which they were able to achieve, which they never would have been able to achieve had a different outcome happened at the end of World War II. So it is this great, let's say, benevolence of the United States to go out and establish peace and prosperity throughout the world, but specifically in the Pacific, with our former hardened enemy, which laid the foundation for much of what we were able to accomplish out there.
Yeah. Our guest is Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. And, Admiral, there were elements to this post-World War II American-dominated order that extended beyond just, of course, our sheer military might and presence, particularly in the Western Pacific. There were also economic mechanisms, the whole Bretton Woods structure. There was the United Nations and so on. You were at one point assigned to represent our government there at the United Nations. Talk a little bit about looking at it now and some of the very significant tectonic shifts that are taking place in the region. And for that matter, economically as well, that are buffeting all of that.
Well, as I mentioned previously, Frank, you know, the communists were able to seriously penetrate all our agencies leading up to, during, and in the post-World War II period, which had a tremendous impact on our policies. And today we're facing the same thing, but if the difference is the Muslim Brotherhood penetration into all our agencies, and which has had a tremendous impact on where we're going today as they've shaped our policies, certainly under the Obama administration, where they've been able to make their greatest penetrations, not only into our national security and intelligence agency, but also to the Congress of the United States. And all of this must be turned around. With the new administration coming in, these must be purged, or we'll see we will be turned around just like the Soviets were able to do with their undercover agents in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this that I know you've got some strong views on, Admiral. In light of the very aggressive buildup of China's military and the relative weakening of the United States military, both in terms of the number of ships that it has, the presence that it's able to maintain in the region, and so on, what did you make of Donald Trump's phone call to Taiwan the other day, and some of the thrashing that it is unleashed in the elite and punditry?
Well, first of all, he didn't make the phone call. He accepted the phone call, and which, let's face it, no president or president-elect should be dictated to from Beijing on who they can talk to. In fact, I go back to the Carter administration. I never agreed with what they did with China, nor did I ever agree with them turning over our Panama Canal to a corrupt organization, one of the great eight strategic waterways in the world. Having said that, I believe it's absolutely necessary that we hold China to the rule of law. As you know, all their illegal claims to their dominance of the South China Sea, which is a key strategic maritime area that over $5 trillion worth of economic maritime traffic go through that area every year to our key allies, Japan, South Korea, and also to coming here to the United States. And, of course, we have our problem. We have a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines, and who have a new president that he is trying to cozy up to Beijing and back off some of the Philippine position on protecting their sovereignty and territory in the South China Sea is certainly of concern. However, I have indications from the Philippine military they're not going to let him stray too far off the reservations before they put some bounds on him.
So, in short, Admiral, your view is that the phone call to or with the Taiwanese president was an important strategic development, not simply a courtesy?
Well, I think the fact that he took the phone call sends a very definite signal that we may be more open and forthcoming with our relations with Taiwan. And your listeners have to understand, Taiwan is a key strategic piece of territory. We always considered Taiwan the equivalent of three carrier strike groups, and they're key to keeping open the maritime sea lanes of communication, which is the foundation of the United States Navy of freedom of the seas.
Could I ask you very quickly, Admiral, just in closing, we're out of time, I'm afraid, but the choke points that you've referred to and the surrender of the Panama Canal to a corrupt, government at the time, but it was more of a criminal enterprise. But it's now basically fallen under the effective control of the Chinese communists, hasn't it? And what are the strategic implications of that? Very quickly, sir.
Well, the problem is they control both ends of the canal. They have the container ports at both ends of the canal, both on the Gulf of Mexico side and both on the Pacific side. So, you know, in any they're in a position to do untold damage to that canal should that ever become an issue, or should we ever become involved in any type of conflict with China, or from an economic standpoint, disrupting the flow of normal commercial traffic through that critical strategic waterway.
Admiral James Ace Lyons, we salute you for your great service to our country over many years. Thank you for this retrospective on Pearl Harbor on the eve of the anniversary, its 75th anniversary, as well as the look ahead to the challenges facing our country and the Trump presidency. God bless you, sir. Keep up the good work. Next up, we'll talk with Michael Cutler about immigration challenges and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is my privilege and pleasure to have with us, as we often do, Michael Cutler, veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Service for some 30 years, including service at JFK Airport. He worked closely with the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Unified Intelligence Division in its operations in New York. He is these days a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization, a very active contributor to the public policy debate, particularly about matters near and dear to his heart and ours, immigration and interior enforcement of our immigration laws. He is, among other things, a contributing editor to Family Security Matters and has testified many times before Congress. It's great to have you back. Michael, thank you so much for some of your time today.
Always great joining you, Frank.
Let me ask you about a story that has gotten some attention, I think not nearly enough, but I'm sure sort of serves as kind of a microcosm for all of us about what is going on in the closing days of the Obama administration. Talk, if you would, about this deal that the Obama team has struck with Australia and what we know about it and, more to the point, what we don't know about it.
Well, very worrying. You know, the administration that said it was going to be the most transparent apparently thinks that lead-lined walls are windows. It's amazing. They have agreed, the administration has agreed, to take refugees that Australia has turned down for reasons that concern the Australian government. But this administration has agreed to take those refugees and refuses to divulge the reasons that Australia won't take them, or the reasons why this administration will take them.
Yeah, or even where they're coming from, right?
Right, where they're coming from, what their backgrounds are, why it is we need to bring them here, especially after the warnings by John Brennan, the head of the CIA, that the terrorists, that the ISIS and other terror groups were embedding their terrorist operatives in refugee flows. This is very worrying, very disturbing, and it's yet another mess that the incoming Trump administration will probably have to address shortly after being sworn into office.
Another one that we have discussed from time to time is this phenomenon which seems now to be proliferating of sanctuary cities, state legislatures actually, I guess, creating sanctuary states at this point. Remind us what that means, sanctuary cities or states, Michael Cutler, and what its implications are for the enforcement of the federal laws.
Well, by the way, I also have a forthcoming article at Front Page about sanctuary colleges. You know, our immigration laws were designed for two primary purposes, to protect national security and public safety and to protect the jobs of Americans. It's very simple. And now it seems that the way that it's being peddled, this concept of sanctuaries, is that it's somehow heroic to keep immigration, those evil immigration agents, out of the loop, even though if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, and, you know, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, I've arrested terrorists in my career. First and foremost, it was failures of the immigration system that enabled terrorists to enter the United States and then embed themselves, hide in plain sight. So you now have cities saying to illegal aliens, if you live in our town, and even if the police arrest you, don't worry, we will never, ever cooperate with those evil immigration authorities so that they might deport you. And we're talking about criminals, we're talking about child molesters, we're talking about rapists. There was just a case involving a Dominican national who is accused of raping a child, and the law enforcement of Pennsylvania refused to honor a detainer lodged by ICE. It took a year for ICE agents to finally find this guy, and you have to wonder how many more children may have been victimized. And the mayor bragged about it and said, we're protecting these people. We have the same madness in New York City. Look, this isn't about discrimination. Immigration law enforcement is about protecting lives, and the people most at risk are the members of the ethnic immigrant communities where these individuals live, because that's where they're going to set up shop, among the people where they're most comfortable, where they're less likely to stick out. So how in the world is it heroic and pro-immigrant to create an environment that attracts criminals, fugitives, terrorists, and other individuals who pose a threat to public safety. This whole idea is absolute lunacy, and like a bad virus, it seems to be spreading.
Another example of this lunacy is one that has been reported in the past 24 hours by our friend Richard Pollack. He talks about the federal government refusing to divulge records of assaults on orphaned immigrant children that are in the care of these federal detention centers, what have you, under the supervision of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. It seems as though they're not even keeping records of the kinds of crimes that are being perpetrated against these children. It just seems as though this is another example of a system that has really become dysfunctional. And I imagine that you would conclude that at the very least, we ought to stop bringing more of these children in until we get our hands around what's happening in this case.
You would think, especially if they're at risk. But you see, this administration has been about keeping, keeping us in the dark. I call it the mushroom treatment, keeping Americans in the dark and feeding them a lot of fertilizer. And that's exactly what they've been doing. When people are killed by illegal aliens, rather than saying we need to address the issue the way we would when you had cars that had runaway acceleration or, you know, it's estimated that about 7,000 people every year are killed in America by people who shouldn't be here, aliens who have no inherent right to be in the United States. And that statistic came out when Congressman Steve King of Iowa asked me a question at a hearing several years ago. He asked if I knew how many people lost their lives every year to illegal aliens. And I told him I didn't know. But that my hunch was it would be a multiple of the number of people who died on 9/11. Of course, 3,000 dead on 9/11. So he commissioned a study by the GAO that came up with that number of 7,000. So this is not inconsequential. And there are others whose murders and harm, again, not being reported, the numbers might even be higher. And yet this administration will do everything and anything to interfere with any enforcement effort to restore integrity to the immigration system.
Yeah, one of the other ways in which this is being practiced, apparently, is they are suspending overflights monitoring at the southwest border. Is that right? Can this possibly be the case?
You know, I was astonished when I heard about it, and then I've seen published reports about it. The idea that this administration has basically turned our border into a speed bump, and that seems to have been the goal of this administration ever since it was sworn into office. You know, the George W. Bush administration was not my hero on the issue of immigration. The arrest of Border Patrol agents Ramos and Compion and all sorts of other open borders policies. But this administration has done more damage to immigration law enforcement and border security than any administration since my involvement with the immigration issue. And I started in 1971.
It's a real wrecking operation, isn't it? Bill O'Reilly had last night on his program an interview in which he deprecated, I believe, with Charles Krauthammer, the value of something called E-Verify, which Charles was rather high on. Would you talk about the importance of that program to sort of internal immigration law enforcement and, you know, the attraction, the magnet of employment opportunities here for people trying to get in?
The majority of illegal aliens who run the border or violate their visas do so to work. So this creates a very huge haystack in which some very deadly needles, terrorists, criminals, fugitives are hiding. E-Verify is a way of verifying identities of employees being hired by companies, and it's a useful program, but there's a caveat. It would require that we have enough agents operating within the United States, ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, to make certain that people use the system. You know, it's kind of a spy versus spy thing. When police started using radar detectors, speeders went out and bought radar detectors. You know, so you've got the radar gun in the hand of the cop and the radar detector on the dashboard of the speeder. Companies that don't want to abide by the immigration laws, unless they are audited, unless investigations are conducted, can easily hire people off the books. We've seen that anyway, whether or not E-Verify is a factor. See, immigration requires a unified strategy. Just like securing the Mexican border alone won't do anything. You know, I wrote for Front Page Magazine, the Immigration and Border Security, the Immigration Colander. there's many holes in the system. They've all got to be plugged simultaneously.
Michael Cutler, your leadership in all of these areas at California's for Population Stabilization and Front Page Magazine and elsewhere is greatly appreciated, as are your visits with us. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, my colleague Kyle Scheidler will join us. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. My colleague Kyle Scheidler, the director of the Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy, is in the house. Kyle is a man who has been closely monitoring and extraordinarily thoughtfully analyzing the danger posed to this country by the Muslim Brotherhood, an outfit Admiral Lyons talked about at the top of the program, very actively engaged in their words, destroying Western civilization from within. That from a document that Kyle Scheidler and others have helped us bring to the public in the center's Brotherhood Archival Series, a collection of very important products that help expose what this outfit is about and the extent to which it has been successfully operating in our country for some 50 years. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure. I wanted to talk with you today because we have just rolled out the latest in this series of the archives, the fruits of the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk about the new book and what the organization is that it sheds light on.
So the most recent member of the archival series is entitled Care is Hamas, How the Federal Government Proved That the Council on American-Islamic Relations is a front for terrorism. So what we wanted to do with this book is take a look at a seminal event in our understanding of the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood, which was the 1993 so-called Philly meeting, a meeting in Philadelphia of the Palestine Committee of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Palestine Committee's job was, according to the federal government, to provide money, media, and men for the cause of Hamas in the Palestinian territories. Now, in 1993, the Oslo Accords had been signed, and the leadership of the Brotherhood is concerned that Hamas will become a designated terrorist organization, and they are making preparations to deal with that eventuality. What they didn't know at the time was that the FBI had literally taped every word of it.
And as the FBI was engaged in surveillance of this organizational meeting of what came to be known as the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE by its acronym, the Bureau has it seems, been doing a lot less of this of late than it used to, but they did capture, among others, a fellow by the name of Niyad Awad, kind of in flagrante with these representatives of Hamas. Remind us who Niyad Awad is, Kyle Scheidler, and what role he plays today.
Sure. Niyad Awad is the executive director of the Council of American Islamic Relations. And according to the FBI and the Department of Justice, Niyad Awad was also a leading member of the Palestine Committee, which they entered into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial. So the FBI knows and has fully documented that Niyad Awad is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, that he is specifically a member of the Palestine Committee, which has a role in supporting Hamas. And now, Niyad Awad, at this meeting, his topic was the media and how the members of the Palestine Committee should work the media and the political angle. And the question that they were facing was, how do we discuss this topic? How do we discuss it in a way that is Sharia compliant, that is in accordance with Islamic law, while not giving the game away, so to speak? And so what they determined was they needed to create a new organization that could carry an Islamic mantle, but at the same time would not be carrying the stigma that was associated with the other elements of the Palestine Committee. And so this organization would eventually become CARE.
And by describing CARE as a civil rights organization using it to try to, infiltrate, influence, subvert, suborn members of Congress, the executive branch, the press, it really was playing the role that was envisioned for it at this Philly meeting in 1993, wasn't it? A political warfare arm for Hamas as well as a fundraising device.
Well, that's exactly right. If you look at what they talk about in the Philly meeting, this organization needing to do, they talk about the need to, and I'm quoting here, infiltrate the media, universities, and research centers. They talk about the need to lobby Congress, which, of course, we know that CARE does to the tune of several hundred thousand dollars. And they talk about the need to defend other supporters of terrorists in order to bolster them, defend them from the Justice Department, and prop up their position in the Muslim community. So that Muslims will continue to support these brotherhood organizations despite pressure from the government. So they talk about all of these things being their tasks. And of course, if we look at what CARE actually does, that is CARE's role.
Now, Kyle Scheidler, when you talk about the insights of this book, describe a little bit about its contents. This book, CARE is Hamas, is available, by the way, folks, for free as a PDF, a downloadable document at securefreedom.org. CARE is Hamas is its title. The curator of the series is our guest, Kyle Scheidler. What is inside the cover of this important new book, Kyle Scheidler?
So because the Philadelphia meeting was a long-ranging two-day meeting where they jumped around in topic and discussion, and there are a lot of different speakers, many of whom are not be familiar to the audience, what we chose to do was highlight the testimony of FBI agent Laura Burns as she walks the prosecutor and the jury through the Philadelphia meeting line by line, so to speak.
This is so, in the course of the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history. I don't know that we mentioned that, the Holy Land Foundation
trial
correct.
In
2008.
This is the testimony at the Holy Land Foundation trial. So she is walking the jury through the Philadelphia meeting, explaining who the players were, explaining what the discussion is. At the same time, of course, we have to remember that the topic of the Holy Land Foundation is the Holy Land Foundation itself and the other five defendants. So it's not focused necessarily on CARE and some of these other players. So what we did was we provided additional commentary and annotation to give the reader information about people that are named in the wiretaps or maybe mentioned as an aside by FBI agent Burns, but they don't have necessarily the details on. So we provide some of those details as well, along with citations to defend them.
I really salute you, Kyle, for the hard work that went into this. The cumulative effect of which is to give the reader a very important insight into this organization that many of us hear about, usually described in very positive terms, as I said, as a civil rights organization, as an entity that is standing up for innocent Muslims and the like. And yet what you've really shown with this document, CARE is Hamas, is that it is a front for jihadist terror.
Ultimately, yes, they are supporters, defenders, and in several cases among membership of CARE, actually themselves full-blooded terrorists. And what we have tried to accomplish is to allow, just as the Justice Department did at the Holy Land Foundation trial, allow them to damn themselves in their own words. So this is not about our opinions. This is not about our views. It is about what exists in evidence.
Kyle, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this important new book. I hope everyone will check out all of the archival series and, for that matter, all of the other terrific books produced by the Center for Security Policy. Kyle, keep up the good work. Next up, Diana West joins us for our weekly visit with her right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, now a blogger of renown at dianawest.net, and the author of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. We catch up with her in the wilds of Vermont, where she is vacationing, but she is always good to rise to the occasion and visit with us. Diana West, thank you so much for doing so. Good to talk with you.
Wonderful to be with you, Frank.
Let me ask you, Diana, about something I discussed with Admiral Lyons at the top of the show, calling to note your efforts to chronicle what the old Soviet Union did to try to subvert the United States at a critical moment in the run-up to World War II. Give us a little of the backstory there, if you would.
Yes, well, this is really part of the lost history in terms of what the conventional wisdom entails. The history is well chronicled before us, and this is what Admiral Lyons is very bravely elucidating in his latest op-ed, and it has to do with the influence operations that were quite brilliantly run out of Moscow, targeting all of the central capitals of the world at this point, coming toward war, or coming toward certainly possibly coming toward war. And this would be Washington, D.C., this would be London, this would be Tokyo, this would also be Berlin. I mean, they were tremendously organized in the secret covert world of intelligence war. And as it pertains to our own Pearl Harbor attack by the Japanese, what you go back and look at is this was not just some kind of out of a clear blue sky sneak attack as we've all been taught. This was something that was very carefully influenced, pushed along by Soviet operators led by Richard Sorge in Tokyo, by Soviet operators led by Harry Dexter White in Washington and elsewhere, trying to nudge the actors toward conflagration with each other rather than, and the point of it was in terms of the Pacific War, to keep Japan from attacking the Soviet Union. So everything was being done to bring the United States and America to war, and it worked.
This bears a certain resemblance, this kind of foreign influence operation, to what seems to be going on at the moment. You were among the signers on a very important letter, as was I, arguing that there should be real concern and national level attention paid by the Congress and the executive branches to foreign funded influence, violence, and constitutional threats. There's a website at which this letter can be found, the Great American Movement, .com, and I commend it to everyone, greatamericanmovement.com. But Diana, talk a little bit about the genesis of this letter and its importance.
Yes, well, we've been living through a period of great civil stress in terms of movements on the left arising, coming together, and creating violence and discord in the land over the election results. And what this letter does, and really, Frank, this picks up with what we've been talking about not only for a very, very long time, but even last week, in terms of this letter conjures up the idea that, yes, there are foreign and hostile actors working to subvert our system that we no longer pay any attention to in any kind of official way. And what this letter tries to do is to really call on the appropriate, branches of government, in this case Congress and other important and critical observers here, to start treating the notion of an enemy within with the seriousness it deserves. One of the victories of communism, probably the greatest victory of communism in the 20th century, was to erase the concept of a domestic enemy from the American mindset. This is what was lost in the sort of poisonous miasma of McCarthyism, which is a completely concocted hysteria that arises anytime anybody notices that people are conspiring to do us harm domestically.
You know, Admiral Lyons spoke specifically of one such threat vector, Diana West, namely the Muslim Brotherhood. And there's no question that it obtains foreign support and funding, but it also draws upon, as we saw in the Holy Land Foundation trial, which we were discussing in the segment previous to yours with Kyle Scheidler, as it exposed aspects of the Muslim Brotherhood, notably the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a front for Hamas in the United States. But, Diana, there's also evidence that there's a continuing partnership between such Islamist or Islamic supremacist entities and the hard left on the one hand and the Black Lives Matter groups on the other. Talk about how they seem to be joining forces for the purposes of, well, most immediately delegitimizing the Trump mandate, but more broadly, seemingly, you know, the constitutional republic that he would lead.
Well, you mentioned a very, very important word there, which is front groups. These are all front groups. And again, looking to the lessons of the past, we learned how communists organized, how foreign actors organized through using front groups, which entail hardened operatives who gather around them what were known at the time as useful fools and also fellow travelers who are also have guilty knowledge of what they're doing, but they're not actually of the organized, official class of an actual communist agent, or in this case, an Islamic agent. And what we're seeing is just an expansion and really retooling of a lot of these same movements. I mean, the Black Lives Matter, for example, the Black Lives Matter separatist or Black Panther separatist movements go back to the Black communist separatist movements that we saw being articulated and moved and discussed and pushed for back in the 1920s. So, I mean, a lot of these ideas have currency that go back to the early 20th century for sure. So really we're seeing an enlargement of the clans with the Islamic vector. I think the Islamic vector joins in quite neatly with this entire panoply of leftist organizations, because they are all essentially collectivist, as we've talked about in terms of the alignment of communist and Islamic interests. They're collectivist, they're anti-constitutional, and they have a very different worldview that they seek to impose on America as part of a global sense of aspiration and goals.
Diana, let me just ask you about one last thing before we have to let you go, and that is Europe. There is a resistance clearly now being exhibited in France, in Italy, but close call in Austria, but elsewhere as well, to the same kind of elite transnational agenda, the Islamist overlay and the like. Could you just very quickly sort of capture what you think is going on there and what it might mean for us?
Well, this is the signs of life. I mean, these are the signs of life we've been looking for at least 15 years, and they are really showing, and they are really materializing. I mean, this is a very critical moment. I think we see when we go back and document it, we can see certainly the importance of the rise of a Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, who we can all hope will become prime minister this spring. It's not out of the question. The Brexit vote was a watershed. The election of Donald Trump. All of these things are indeed related, and now we see these same kinds of movements in the other European countries coming to bear fruit, we hope, because this is the democratic movement against these elites. They're not just transnational, they're not just collectivist, they are anti-democratic, they are dictatorial, and that is the why you see them, so many people in the EU, for example, praising Castro and death. I mean, this is they are all of the same ilk.
Diana, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for your time this week and every week. We enjoy our conversations with you tremendously and benefit from them greatly. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.